GatesFoundation.org.
I'm Gina Cervetti. Tonight, a lecture on the Earth Charter, which is described on its website as a declaration of fundamental principles for building a just, sustainable, and peaceful global society. Our main speaker is Stephen Rockefeller, professor emeritus at Middlebury College in Vermont. He is introduced by Jeffrey Henderson, dean of Boston University's School of Arts and Sciences. The lecture is presented by Boston University's Institute for Philosophy and Religion. Dean Henderson.
The Institute was established in 1970 as a cooperative venture among the departments of philosophy and religion in arts and sciences and the School of Theology. And since then, it's done many things for our faculty and students in the way of sharing research interests and ideas and special topics. It's also a voice to the community in articulating from the academic side philosophical, religious, thoughtful commentary on issues of interest not only in academia but to the public at large. And it's been very successful at this over the years. The theme of this year's Institute program is responsibility. And I can think of no more important topic under that rubric than humanity's responsibility for our planet, not least the responsibility that must be borne by the developed nations. I think it's a timely topic also because of the great environmental interest across Boston University and all of the schools, arts and sciences, and all the other schools in some way have an active intellectual involvement in issues relating to the environment, both from the scientific side all the way over to the humanities side and everywhere in between. It's a big topic. It's the big topic, I think, for our new millennium and our new century, and Boston University plans to play an important role in that. And I think that today's presentation should be taken in the context of a university-wide interest in this topic. And now let me introduce our speaker for this evening. We're very pleased and honored to have Stephen Rockefeller, Professor Emeritus of Religion at Middlebury College, Vermont, where he taught for 30 years and served as Dean of the College and Chair of the Religion Department. He received his Master of Divinity from Union Theological Seminary in New York and his PhD in the Philosophy of Religion from Columbia. Among his publications are John Dewey, Religious Faith and Democratic Humanism, and Spirit and Nature, Why the Environment is a Religious Issue. In recent years, much of his research and writing has focused on sustainable development and global ethics, and on the interrelation of ecology, democracy, and spirituality. Active in the field of philanthropy, Professor Rockefeller chairs the Board of Trustees of the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, an international grant-making foundation based in New York with programs in democratic practice, sustainable development, peace and security, and arts and culture. He's also a trustee of the Asian Cultural Council. Over the past decade, Professor Rockefeller has been actively involved in the Earth Charter Initiative, which in and through extensive worldwide cross-cultural dialogue has endeavored to identify and articulate shared values that provide an ethical foundation for the emerging global economy. He chaired the Earth Charter International Drafting Committee from 1997 to 2000, and for the past 3 years, he has served as a member of the Earth Charter Commission. The broad goal of the Earth Charter is to educate, to advocate, and even to pressure the developed nations to take action on its 16 principles for developing a sustainable global society, a society based on respect for nature, on universal human rights, on economic justice, and on a culture of peace. The making of the Charter is the topic of his presentation to us this afternoon. So join me in welcoming Professor Rockefeller.
Thank you very much, Dean Henderson. I'd like to start with a story about Oliver Wendell Holmes. The story is that just as Holmes got on the train in Philadelphia and took his seat, and when the conductor came and asked him for his ticket, he couldn't find it. And he searched in his pocket, and he searched in his briefcase, and he became increasingly frustrated. And finally, the conductor recognized him and said, Justice Holmes, he said, don't worry about your ticket. When you find it, you can mail it into the Pennsylvania Railroad. And Justice Holmes looked up at him with a very perturbed expression and said, "My good man, the question is not where is my ticket. The question is, where am I going?" And that's a question that I think many of us find ourselves asking today when we look at the newspapers and television programs and read the commentary on the current state of the world. We live today in an era of increasing global interdependence and mounting social and ecological problems that put at risk the well-being of all peoples and the greater community of life on Earth. As a species, we're not adjusting well to the challenge. In general, our political and business leaders, our major institutions, and most of us as individuals are not doing what we must to reverse the trends that threaten our future. One fundamental cause of this state of affairs, and perhaps the root cause, is a lack of a deep sense of shared responsibility for our world as a whole and for future generations. In my remarks, I'd like to explore this issue with you, giving special attention to the Earth Charter, which is an international declaration of global interdependence and universal responsibility that sets forth fundamental ethical principles for building a just, sustainable, and peaceful world. By way of introduction, it's useful to describe briefly the global situation that provides the context for understanding the urgent need for a new sense of social and ecological responsibility. And I would then like to make a few general comments about the concept of responsibility itself and its great social and psychological significance. And this will lead to a discussion of the Earth Charter and its vision of a new global ethics and what the Earth Charter calls universal responsibility. Under the impact of industrialization, the information revolution, economic globalization, and new systems of global governance, human societies everywhere on Earth are undergoing major changes. In short, we have entered what can be described as the planetary phase in the development of civilization and the era of global history. What distinguishes the emerging situation from the past is the increasing interdependence of all people environmentally, economically, politically, and culturally. As a result, our distinct individual and local stories are also part of one planetary story, as never before. However, it is not at all clear where the forces and processes causing globalization are leading the world. If some of the dominant trends are not reversed, we will face increasingly serious environmental, economic, and social problems. For example, under the impact of the current form of economic growth, with its patterns of production and consumption, together with patterns of population growth, the health of the planet's ecosystems is steadily deteriorating. Since all life in the human economy are dependent on the goods and services provided by ecosystems, the consequences of ongoing ecological degradation can be catastrophic. In addition, almost half the world's peoples have received little or no benefit from the process of economic globalization and live in crippling poverty. One recent study estimates that out of the 6.4 billion people on Earth today, only 1.7 billion are part of the global consumer class. The UN reports that almost 3 billion people live on less than $2 a day in conditions that make it impossible for them to secure their basic human rights. And the gap between the rich and the poor continues to grow. Many governments in the developed world and business leaders have put their faith in free markets as the long-term solution to these ecological and social ills. However, the current system of free markets does not protect the environment, and it does not effectively address the need for greater economic equity. And governments have been unwilling or unable to correct the markets. Nuclear proliferation, war, terrorism, organized crime, the spread of infectious disease, religious fanaticism, and intolerance add to the many dangers we face and greatly complicate the situation today. Reflecting on the ever-changing, increasingly complex state of global affairs, futurists, such as the Global Scenario Group, which is based at the TELUS Institute here in Boston, construct both positive and negative scenarios. On one extreme, they imagine that given current trends, the world could be headed for progressive ecological breakdown, spreading poverty and increasing violence, leading to a new planetary dark ages. In this scenario, the world becomes divided into a few heavily armed and fortified bastions of dwindling wealth and privilege, outside of which the mass of humanity form an ungovernable sea of misery. On the other extreme, there is the hope that in this age of global interdependence, human society will undergo a great transition that leads to the emergence of an equitable and ecologically sustainable world community that respects cultural diversity. As Reinhold Niebuhr put it 50 years ago in his classic study of Christianity and Democracy, The Children of Light and the Children of Darkness, building a genuine world community is humanity's ultimate social and political challenge. Today, it is an evolutionary possibility that has become an ecological and social necessity. In our increasingly interdependent and complex world, no one nation, not even the most powerful, can protect itself and manage the challenges that face it alone. Multilateral cooperation and new systems of international law and global governance are required. In addition, over the past two decades, there has been a growing recognition that all of the major problems facing the planet are interrelated, and none of them can be effectively dealt with in isolation. Poverty eradication, economic justice, democracy, universal access to education and health care, the conservation of natural resources, environmental protection, national security and peace are all interdependent. Holistic thinking and integrated problem solving on a global as well as local level is essential. Now, this leads to another critical point. Building and maintaining an international order that promotes effective collaboration requires agreement on common goals and shared values. In order to ensure a promising future, the process of globalization must be guided by a widely shared vision of a better world and a new global ethics that gives soul to the process of globalization and a unifying and healing spirit to the emerging planetary civilization. The Earth Charter Initiative arose in the late 1980s as an effort to address this issue. The basic mission of the initiative is to establish a sound ethical foundation for the emerging global society and to ensure and to nurture a new sense of global citizenship and shared ecological and social responsibility. Now, before turning to the story of the Earth Charter and its understanding of universal responsibility, it's helpful to clarify the meaning of the concept of responsibility and to describe in broad outline its fundamental significance for society and human development. Regarding the definition of the concept, if I am responsible for something or somebody, it means that I am accountable in these matters. Responsibility in general is moral or legal accountability. In addition to speaking about being responsible for certain things, we also speak about being responsible to others. For example, parents are responsible for the welfare of their children, and they are responsible to their children and to society for doing so. We may speak about being responsible to ourselves for the development of our unique abilities and the integration of our personalities. Many people feel ultimately accountable to God. But under the impact of science and secularism, this sensibility has been weakened. The issue of to whom we are accountable is a very important one. It involves recognition that we are not here on this earth for ourselves alone. We are members of communities, and the meaning and value of life is found in and through responsible relationships. Now, there is a more, the concept of responsibility is closely related to the idea of freedom. If we hold a person responsible for his or her conduct, we assume that the person is in some meaningful way, and in meaningful sense, a free agent capable of determining his or her actions, Responsibility implies freedom of choice. But there is a more basic connection between responsibility and freedom. With freedom goes responsibility. And the more freedom we have, the greater our responsibility. Our ethical obligations are our most fundamental responsibilities. In brief, with freedom comes the ethical responsibility to do what is good and to avoid what is evil in our relations with others and in our relation to ourselves. Now, this insight and general ethical guideline is fundamental to the teaching of all the world's great religions and is a key to human development and the flourishing of civilization. Our sense of ethical responsibility springs from two sources. One is social, and the other is psychological and spiritual. First, as social beings, people are interdependent members of communities. The survival and flourishing of a community requires the mutual support and cooperation of its members. Humanity's ethical values and sense of responsibility have developed and have been promoted by society in order to sustain the communities on which people are dependent. Second, psychologically, human beings have the capacity to recognize others as persons and to identify and sympathize with their desire to avoid harm, live fully, and have the love and support of others. Our social interdependence prompts us for practical reasons to become responsible, and our sympathy and compassion inspire us to take our ethics and responsibilities to heart. In the early stages of history and human development, moral consideration is extended only to those with whom an individual is directly interdependent, that is, to members of his or her family and tribe. However, over the past 3,000 years, humanity's moral consciousness has expanded slowly and often painfully to embrace ever wider human communities. All members of a confederation of tribes, a nation, or a religion, and finally all members of the human species. The expansion of a person's capacity to identify and sympathize with ever wider circles of people and to recognize and accept broader responsibilities reflects the increasing interdependence of diverse people, the building of wider human communities, and the spiritual growth of the self. As the world becomes increasingly interdependent, and the need for common goals and shared values becomes urgent, the question naturally arises as to whether agreement on a planetary ethic is a realistic goal. Now, there are many skeptics. They point out that a comparative analysis of different cultures reveals great diversity in the systems of ethical values that those cultures have developed. However, in the midst of this diversity, anthropologists and political philosophers find widespread agreement on certain basic ethical principles. Examples are the Golden Rule and the closely related twofold imperative: help others, and if you can't do that, at a minimum, don't harm them. Sometimes I think we ought to put that on a big billboard right over New York City. In accord with these general principles, there is in all cultures a certain moral minimum of common values involving positive duties and responsibilities regarding mutual care and support, negative duties and responsibilities involving constraints on harming others and violence, and certain rudimentary guidelines for procedural justice and fairness. Common values do exist. Furthermore, the universally accepted social responsibilities regarding mutual support and the avoidance of harm have evolved over time into the modern concept of human rights. Human rights were initially promoted in an effort to protect the individual from abuse and oppression by the state. However, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights has become the core of a new, widely shared global ethic that articulates basic rights and responsibilities that pertain to the behavior of individuals, organizations, and governments everywhere. Today, if one asks, what does it mean to do what is good and to avoid what is evil? One basic answer is respect the human rights and fundamental freedoms of every woman, man, girl, and boy, regardless of their race, religion, gender, ethnic origin, nationality, and sexual orientation, and build the social and political institutions necessary to secure human rights and promote human development. The concept of universal human rights suggests the outlines of a free, just, democratically governed world and begins to give definition to the ideas of human solidarity and global citizenship. Now, even though the Charter of the United Nations and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights go far in providing general guidelines for the ethical responsibilities that come with freedom in the 21st century, they do not provide a complete account of those responsibilities. And this brings us to the story of the Earth Charter and to a discussion of our ecological as well as social responsibilities. Now, the Earth Charter initiative grew out of dialogues and debates over common values and human responsibilities generated by the United Nations. Some background in this regard is necessary in order to understand how and why the Earth Charter emerged. First of all, it's important to note the approach of the UN system to common values. Some critics charge that attempts to create a planetary ethics invariably involves cultural imperialism, that is, one culture or religion attempting to impose its values on everyone else. Even though over the centuries there have been many political and religious leaders who have dreamed of such a scheme, the UN has chosen a very different methodology. It has endeavored to identify common values by finding common ground through cross-cultural dialogue. The creation of the Earth Charter reflects this approach. A bit of history is instructive. When the United Nations was formed following World War II, its agenda for world security focused on the promotion of human rights, world peace, and equitable socioeconomic development. No mention was made of the environment as a common concern in the Charter of the UN, and little attention was given to the subject during the first 25 years of the organization's existence. That changed with the convening of the United Nations Stockholm Conference on the Human Environment in 1972. During the 1970s, there was growing support for a new human right to a healthy environment, and environmental security became a fourth major focus of United Nations programs. In 1982, the United Nations adopted the World Charter for Nature, which is a landmark document in the development of a global environmental ethic. It is the first intergovernmental declaration to challenge the prevailing anthropocentrism and to affirm respect for nature as the foundation principle of environmental protection. In other words, while human beings may be dependent upon and have a right to a healthy environment, there is a further and more basic reason to protect the environment. As the World Charter for Nature points out, other species are worthy of respect quite apart from their utilitarian value to people and should not be viewed as resources only, that is, as a mere means to human ends. Other species have value in themselves, what some philosophers call intrinsic value, as distinct from utilitarian value. Now, this is a momentous ethical shift that challenges people to expand their moral consciousness to embrace all life forms in addition to all human beings. This is, of course, not an entirely new idea. Respect for nature and reverence for life are values that have been part of various religious and philosophical traditions for over 2,500 years. However, this outlook has been ignored or rejected for the most part by modern industrial civilization. It is noteworthy that the United States voted against the World Charter, the only nation to do so, and most governments were quick to forget they had ever signed the document. Now, the UN did, however, continue to grapple with the problem of ecological degradation by appointing the World Commission on Environment and Development in the early 80s. The lengthy report of the World Commission, Our Common Future, which was issued in 1987, is one of the most important documents in the history of the global environmental movement. It promotes the idea of sustainable development as the key to a promising future and defines sustainable development as, and I quote, development that meets the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their needs. Even though the concept of sustainable development has never been widely supported in the United States, it has become, for the larger international community, a new big organizing idea, like democracy or human rights. In line with its understanding of sustainable development, the World Commission puts special emphasis on the principle of intergenerational responsibility and the need for long-term thinking and planning. In Our Common Future, there is also a proposal to create a new international charter that would set forth the fundamental ethical principles needed to guide the world in the transition to sustainable development. This recommendation led to efforts to create an Earth Charter during the next major United Nations Conference on Environment and Development, which was held in Rio de Janeiro in 1992. However, largely due to the different perspectives and priorities of the North and the South, an intergovernmental agreement on the Earth Charter could not be reached at the Rio Earth Summit. The Rio Declaration was drafted and issued instead. It articulates more effectively than the World Charter for Nature the interrelation of environmental, social, and economic problems, but it does not include the principle of respect for nature and makes no reference to the World Charter for Nature. In this regard, the Rio Declaration reflects a retreat by governments from the strong environmental ethic in the World Charter for Nature. One major task of the Earth Charter Initiative would be to refocus attention on the ethic of respect for nature as well as intergenerational responsibility. Now, recognizing that there was a need for the Earth Charter and that state governments were unlikely to make the sustained effort required to draft the document, Maurice Strong of Canada, the Secretary General of the Rio Earth Summit, and Mikhail Gorbachev, the former president of the Soviet Union who had become the president of Green Cross International, launched in 1994 a new Earth Charter drafting process as a civil society initiative. The consultation process associated with the creation of the Earth Charter was the most extensive and inclusive process ever conducted in connection with the drafting of an international declaration. Starting in 1995 and building on the work of the Rio Earth Summit, research on the principles to be included in the Earth Charter was conducted in the fields of international, environmental, and sustainable development law, environmental science, philosophy, religion, and ethics. International consultations were conducted in different parts of the world. Early in 1997, an Earth Charter Commission with members from 21 different nations was established to oversee the drafting process, and an international drafting committee was formed. The actual drafting process lasted 3 years, extending from January 1997 to March 2000. In the course of that period, dozens of drafts were produced, only to be revised in the light of new research and a steady flow of comments and recommendations. Hundreds of organizations and thousands of individuals from around the world were involved. Both experts and grassroots community leaders participated. 45 national Earth Charter committees were formed around the world and linked with the Secretariat and the drafting committee. Major regional conferences on draft Earth Charters were held in Asia, Africa, Central and South America, North America, and Europe. The drafting committee worked closely with the international lawyers on the World Conservation Union's International Commission on Environmental Law. Meetings were held with conservation biologists and ecologists on the construction of the science-based principles. Specialists in the field of environmental and sustainable development ethics were regularly consulted. There was ongoing discussions with representatives of indigenous peoples from many different regions. Dialogues on the Earth Charter were conducted in the course of 10 international conferences on religion and ecology, sponsored by the Center for the Study of World Religions at Harvard and at a meeting of the Parliament of the World's Religions in Cape Town, South Africa. During one two-week-long internet conference in 1999, representatives from 300 universities in 78 different countries debated how best to formulate and organize Earth Charter principles. The Earth Charter Commission approved a final text of the document at a meeting at the UNESCO headquarters in Paris, and the Earth Charter was formally launched at the Peace Palace in The Hague at the end of June in 2000. Since then, the Earth Charter has been translated into 28 different languages and circulated around the world. Thousands of organizations and hundreds of cities, including the U.S. Conference of Mayors, have endorsed the document. In the U.S. alone, close to 800 organizations with a total membership of roughly 40 million people have now endorsed the Earth Charter. The Earth Charter is also widely used as a teaching tool in schools, colleges, and universities. The Small Earth Charter Secretariat is currently affiliated with and located at the UN University for Peace in Costa Rica. It operates its own website and focuses largely on supporting the educational use of the Earth Charter and adoption and implementation of the Charter by local governments. Now let me turn to the Charter itself. In the course of drafting the Earth Charter, There were many intense debates over language and concepts, and the drafting committee had to keep in mind that the document should be acceptable to multiple cultures and religious traditions and should reflect the consensus on shared values taking form in the emerging global civil society. Here are a few examples of some of the debates and controversies. Many members of the Earth Charter Commission originally wanted a one-page Earth Charter. However, it soon became apparent that groups on the front line of the environmental movement, like Wangari Maathai's Greenbelt movement in Kenya, needed a more substantial document. Many Christian groups lobbied for a reference to God or the Creator, but it was decided that God language was not appropriate because it is not used in some religions as well as non-religious groups. The document does call for reverence for the mystery of being, and that term, the mystery of being, can be interpreted naturalistically or theologically if one is so inclined. There was criticism from conservative religious groups regarding the use of the name Earth with a capital E on the grounds that it implied earth worship and neo-paganism. It's very interesting. If you look at international documents, you go back to the Stockholm document, it refers to the earth with a small e. But by the time you get to the Rio Declaration, it's the earth with a capital E. And when you get to the Earth Charter, the definite article is gone. Now, using the name Earth was, we stuck with Earth, the name Earth with a capital E, because it is the name of our planet used by scientists and evokes the image of the planet in space given to us by the astronauts. Using the name Earth was also strongly supported by indigenous peoples around the world. If it also pleased neo-pagans, that was fine. We wanted the Earth Charter to affirm the intrinsic value of all life forms, but we did not use the term intrinsic value because many Buddhist philosophers object to it. The language we ended up with in Principle 1A is a blend of philosophical and scientific terminology from both the East and the West. The drafting committee worked very closely with the International Women's Movement, but there was resistance among some men in developing countries and in some Muslim groups to the call for gender equality in Principle 10. These critics pressed hard for the use of the term gender equity rather than gender equality. Equity basically means fairness, which can mean many different things in different cultures. In the end of the day, the voice of women leaders in the developing world convinced us that the Earth Charter should call for gender equality and equity. We tried to stay clear of the debate over abortion, but over the objections of some Roman Catholic groups, we felt compelled to recognize the United Nations support for reproductive health care as essential to sustainable population growth. In spite of some resistance, we explicitly include a reference to sexual orientation in the non-discrimination principle. An eloquent plea in support of this reference during the Parliament of the World's Religions from an Indian ambassador and statesman settled the matter. The indigenous peoples from the circumpolar north, who are dependent upon hunting for their food, objected to a draft of Principle 15 that called for treating all living beings with compassion because they argued one cannot hunt with compassion. And when I questioned a man from the circumpolar north, he said, "Mr. Rockefeller, have you ever tried to kill a whale?" This, of course, raised objections from Jains, Hindus, Buddhists, and animal rights activists, among others. In the end, all the parties agreed that all living beings should be treated, quote, with respect and consideration. And the word compassion was moved to Principle 2, a more general principle dealing with caring for the community of life as a whole. And everybody signed on. Animal rights groups, with strong support from Thomas Berry, urged that the Earth Charter use rights language with reference to non-human species. However, the Earth Charter Commission ruled that there was no worldwide consensus on the use of rights language in this context, and it should not be used. The Earth Charter is, however, crystal clear on the fundamental issue addressed by the use of rights language, which is recognition that all life forms and the greater community of life are worthy of respect and moral consideration. There was much debate about how to formulate the precautionary principle, which appears in Principle 6. We ended up with a very strong version of this fundamental guideline that links it in an original way with the principle of prevention and the polluter pays principle. As a result of this strong formulation, we lost the unqualified support of the World Business Council on Sustainable Development. Had we compromised on this principle, we would have lost the support of many environmental NGOs. Now, in and through the give and take of the consultation and drafting process, the organizational structure and wording of the Earth Charter gradually took form. The document that finally emerged, you could give me the first transparency. The document that finally emerged has a preamble, 16 main principles, 61 supporting principles, and a conclusion entitled The Way Forward. As the document grew in length, the principles were divided into four parts with four main principles each. The titles of the four parts, which are on the transparency, indicate the inclusive nature of the Earth Charter vision. Now, the preamble introduces the ethical principles of the Earth Charter with a description of the global challenge and a call for a new sense of shared ecological and social responsibility. Embedded in the preamble is an ethical and spiritual orientation in relation to the world that reflects the insights of a wide variety of religious and philosophical traditions and that is also consistent with contemporary science, especially the new cosmology, physics, and ecology. The general nature of this perspective can be symbolized by an ancient Confucian image, which is right up here, and I hope all of you can see it, which Professor Du Wei Ming, director of the Harvard Yenching Institute and a leading Confucian scholar, shared with the drafting committee. Fundamental to the Earth Charter and this Confucian symbol is a profound sense of the interdependence of all things. The diagram involves concentric circles radiating out from a center, and a cross overlays the concentric circles. The center point of the diagram is the self, and the concentric circles represent the various communities of which the self is a member and in relation to which it has duties and responsibilities. More specifically, the circles nearest the center represent the family and local community, and moving outward, they represent the nation, the whole human family, and the greater community of life on Earth. Beyond the outermost circle, the shading of the diagram is meant to suggest the presence of the larger universe, of which Earth and humanity are also an interconnected part. The horizontal arm of the cross represents the interdependence of the self and the community. This outlook opposes an atomistic individualism, which imagines that the self exists as an independent entity and can find fulfillment or salvation by itself apart from the worlds of which it is a part. According to the social psychology and relational spirituality of this symbol and the Earth Charter, the self realizes the meaning and value of life in and through its relationships to others and the diverse communities of which it is a part, including the greater community of life. This diagram invites the self, then, to identify itself with and extend its sympathy to all peoples and to all living beings, and to feel a sense of responsibility for the future of our world as a whole. The vertical arms of the cross in the Confucian tradition represent the interrelation of heaven and earth. In language closer to the Earth Charter, the vertical arms represent the interdependence of the mysterious power of being at work in the universe and earth, the spiritual and the material, and the ethical and the human. It affirms the vital importance of the spiritual dimension of reality. Now, recognizing that our increasing global interdependence gives the Confucian symbol a new depth of meaning, the Earth Charter affirms, and I quote, "We are one human family and one Earth community with a common destiny." Based on this inclusive sense of community, the Charter then makes this critical assertion. It is imperative that we, the peoples of Earth, declare our responsibility to one another, to the greater community of life, and to future generations. This declaration is a concise expression of the Earth Charter's ethical orientation. It affirms that our moral obligations and accountability extend to all our fellow human beings living on Earth, to all other life forms, and to future generations. Now, with these considerations in mind, the Earth Charter preamble calls for universal responsibility. The sense of ecological and social responsibility that the Earth Charter seeks to support is universal in two senses. First, it is a responsibility shared by everyone, each according to his or her situation and abilities. In the words of the Rio Declaration, it is a matter of common but differentiated responsibilities. Second, in a world where the collective impact of individual actions is increasingly global, everyone shares responsibility for the present and future well-being of the whole human family and the larger living world. Now, the term universal responsibility has special appeal because it complements the concept of universal human rights. It also communicates the meaning of global as well as local citizenship. Now, it was the Dalai Lama who initially brought this term to the attention of the drafting committee. In the Mahayana Buddhist tradition, universal responsibility corresponds closely to the commitment of a bodhisattva, whose compassion and care extends to all living beings, present and future. The term also resonates with the Christian concept of agape, or self-giving love, especially in connection with a figure like St. Francis of Assisi, whose Christ-like love of the world extends to all beings, human and non-human. In introducing the Earth Charter principles, the preamble identifies them as interdependent principles for a sustainable way of life. And you note we use the term sustainable way of life rather than sustainable development, which had become controversial. But the basic notion of sustainability, the Earth Charter Commission felt, was absolutely essential, and the Earth Charter should stick with that language. And we do use the term sustainable development in the Charter, but in this case, where we make this fundamental statement, we use the term interdependent principles for a sustainable way of life. The principles then can be taken as an inclusive definition of the meaning of sustainable living and sustainable human development. Human development is a term developed by the United Nations to counteract the notion that all development is simply economic development. And the UN has put this emphasis that development should be human and have this very, very broad reference as opposed to think of development just in economic terms. Now, the preamble concludes with the statement that the Earth Charter principles are a common standard by which the conduct of all individuals, organizations, businesses, governments, and transnational institutions is to be guided and assessed. That language actually comes from the end of the preamble of the World Charter for Nature, even though it said guided and judged. And I remember Maurice Strong said judged sounds a little bit heavy. Let's just say assessed. But the point here is, and this is a critical point, the Earth Charter is intended as a document to be used, endorsed, and implemented, and it is an instrument for holding people and institutions accountable for how their activities impact on others, the greater community of life, and future generations. The heart of the Earth Charter's understanding of universal responsibility and a sustainable way of living is an ethic of respect and care for the community of life. This theme is stated in Part 1. If you could put the next transparency up. This theme is stated in the title of Part 1. The first four main principles found in Part 1 clarify the general meaning of this ethic. They contain just 39 words and were designed to serve as a concise summary of the Earth Charter's ethical vision. These four very general principles are, as you see there, respect Earth and life in all its diversity, care for the community of life with understanding, compassion, and love, build democratic societies that are just, participatory, sustainable, and peaceful, and secure Earth's bounty and beauty for present and future generations. You see there the three different spheres of ethical responsibility identified: relations of people to all life forms, relations of people in society, and relations of present and future generations. Now, the principles that you find in parts 2, 3, and 4 in the Earth Charter unpack and outline the duties and responsibilities implicit in the four general principles in part 1. Now, time does not permit a discussion of all the Earth Charter principles. However, I do want to point out that the Earth Charter culminates with a principle on creation of a culture of tolerance, nonviolence, and peace. This is the only long-term answer to the problem of terrorism, violent conflict, and security that is so much on everyone's mind today. The peace principle comes last because the building of an enduring peace requires implementation of all the other principles. There will be no peace and security in a world of dwindling resources, collapsing ecosystems, mass poverty, political oppression, and economic inequity. In the final supporting principle, 16F, peace is defined as the wholeness created by right relationships with oneself, other persons, other cultures, other life, Earth, and the larger whole of which we are all a part. This is a vision of what the Jewish tradition calls shalom. A few comments about current developments. One goal of the Earth Charter Initiative has been to secure endorsement of the document by the United Nations as a way of enlisting government support and advancing government cooperation. In the year 2000, the Millennium NGO Forum, which included over 1,000 non-governmental organizations, recommended to the United Nations that the General Assembly endorse the Earth Charter. While this did not happen, the Millennium Declaration issued by the UN General Assembly did, for the first time in 20 years, reaffirm respect for nature as the basic value, as a basic value that should guide the policies and planning of governments. It is very probable that this action reflects the influence of the Earth Charter. 2 years later, in 2002, there was significant government as well as NGO support for including recognition of the Earth Charter in the Johannesburg Declaration, issued by the UN World Summit on Sustainable Development meeting in South Africa. President Mbeki cited the Earth Charter in his opening address at the summit, and the South African government actively supported inclusion of a reference to the Earth Charter in the Johannesburg Declaration. However, on the last day of the summit, the United States delegation forced deletion of the reference to the Earth Charter. Nevertheless, the Johannesburg Declaration does include a statement on humanity's ecological and social responsibility that contains words identical to those in the Earth Charter. These critical words are the statement, "We declare our responsibility to each other, to the greater community of life, and to future generations." By using these words, the Johannesburg Declaration affirms the inclusive ethical orientation of the Earth Charter. In 2003, on recommendation of representatives from the nation of Jordan, and as a result of the leadership of Princess Basma bin Talal, who was a member of the Earth Charter Commission, the UNESCO General Conference of Member States adopted a resolution recognizing the Earth Charter as an important ethical framework for sustainable development and a valuable educational tool. On this occasion, the U.S. supported the action. In accord with this resolution, UNESCO will be incorporating the Earth Charter in the educational materials that it is preparing for the UN Decade of Education for Sustainable Development, which begins in 2005. Another effort will probably be made by the Earth Charter Commission to secure explicit recognition of the Earth Charter by the UN General Assembly sometime in the next year or two. When local governments and other groups endorse the Earth Charter, and hundreds of cities have done so, they often face a difficult challenge in trying to figure out how to implement the principles. In this regard, the World Resources Institute, working with an international advisory committee, is developing practical goals and strategies for the implementation of Earth Charter principles and is also developing measurable indicators that can be used to assess the progress being made. This project will result in an Earth Charter guidebook and computer software program that can be used by local governments and NGOs. These materials will be tested in various cities around the world and adapted to the needs of different regions. This undertaking will greatly enhance the practical and educational value of the Earth Charter. Now, to those of you seeking a fuller understanding of current global challenges and a citizen's guide to the meaning of universal responsibility, I want to highly recommend to you Gus Speth's new book, Red Sky at Morning, America and the Crisis of the Global Environment, which will be in the bookstores in April. As you know, Gus Speth is the founder of the World Resources Institute and the National Resources Defense Council, and he's currently the dean of the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. And this new book is just terrific, and so I recommend it to all of you. In the concluding chapter, Speth gives his support to the Earth Charter's vision for a sustainable future. Now, in conclusion, the Earth Charter recognizes that human beings today have the power to shape the future. The choice is ours, in the words of the Earth Charter preamble. However, we face a crisis in our sense of identity, community, and ethical responsibility. Modern culture has eroded our trust that we are part of a universe with a sacred center, our belief in a moral order governing the universe, and our sense of being ultimately accountable for how we live. There may be a nugget of spiritual truth in these ancient religious ideas that we forget at our own peril. One senses that the creative powers in the universe are struggling to lure humanity forward into a new evolutionary stage, and that one key to this process is the awakening of a new sense of universal responsibility in relation to the Earth community as a whole. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Stephen Rockefeller, Professor Emeritus at Middlebury College in Vermont, speaking on the Earth Charter. Introducing Professor Rockefeller was Jeffrey Henderson, Dean of Boston University's School of Arts and Sciences. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skog and Matt Largy with help from Boris Trapotsky. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Gina Cervetti. Thanks for joining us.